From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is a guy that his entire life he succeeded because of who he is and his family heritage. He went to Andover because of his family connections. He went to Yale because of his father and his grandfather's connections. Texas Law School turned him down, but he got into Harvard because of family connections. He set out in the oil business in Midland back in the 70s, and just because of his family's name, he got a lot of investors, even though all his businesses failed. He never was successful in the oil business. It was all oil, it was all bailouts and swap deals and that type of thing.
Fortunate son, George W. Bush, and the making of an American president. Today, we play an interview with J.H. Hatfield, the author of the book Fortunate Son. He died 2 years ago of an alleged suicide. We never did play this interview until today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Provincetown on Cape Cod. I'm here at Town Hall, where this past April, the annual town meeting voted unanimously for a resolution not to comply with the USA Patriot Act. Here are some of today's headlines. Charles Taylor is expected to step down as Liberian president today at noon Liberia time and hand over power to his vice president. Taylor has been indicted for war crimes. He's expected to go into exile in Nigeria as early as today. In a farewell address on Sunday, Taylor blamed the United States for refusing to offer troops unless he stepped down. He accused the U.S. of using food as a weapon against the Liberian people and challenged Bush to provide Liberia billions with humanitarian aid. He ended his speech by saying, quote, God willing, I will be back. In the days and weeks following the collapse of the World Trade Center, the White House pressured the Environmental Protection Agency to not warn the public about the potential health effects and to not issue guidelines for the public about cleaning apartments and offices after 9/11. That's the conclusion of a yet-to-be-released investigation by the EPA's Inspector General. This according to a report in the New York Times. The report goes on to say the White House's handling of the situation was influenced strongly by its desire to see the stock markets quickly reopen on Wall Street. Israeli jets yesterday bombed targets in South Lebanon after it accused Hezbollah forces there of shelling a northern Israeli town, killing one and injuring five. Hezbollah claimed it did not fire shots, but shot anti-aircraft weapons at Israeli warplanes that had crossed the Lebanese border. Both Israel and Lebanon have lodged complaints with the United Nations. Meanwhile, in Nablus, Israeli forces killed two members of Hamas on Friday night. The Boston Globe's reporting the Bush administration largely ignored a CIA briefing in February that predicted the U.S. would face armed resistance from Iraqis following the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime. A month after the briefing was produced, Vice President Dick Cheney told NBC's Meet the Press, "My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators." Meanwhile, a U.S. soldier was killed and two wounded last night in a bombing in the Iraqi town of Baquba, northeast of Baghdad. On Saturday, two other U.S. soldiers died in Iraq, one of heat stroke, and another was found dead in his bed. The military did not release the cause of death. 263 U.S. troops have now died since the invasion of Iraq began. Massive protests erupted over the weekend in the Iraqi city of Basra against British occupying forces. The Washington Post described it as the worst unrest in Iraq since Baghdad fell. Thousands of Iraqis took to the streets, setting tires on fire to block British troop movements as temperatures topped 120 degrees. The city's mostly without electricity and faces chronic fuel shortages. At least one protester was shot dead. A Nepalese security guard who worked for the foreign firm Global Security was also killed. In southern France, up to 300,000 people rallied over the weekend to protest the upcoming World Trade Organization's set for next month in Cancun, Mexico. More than 190 candidates have filed paperwork to run in the California gubernatorial recall race if voters oust Governor Gray Davis. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization has taken command of peacekeeping forces in Afghanistan. On Saturday, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy called for the elimination of mandatory prison sentences. Concern is growing over touchscreen voting machines after a new study by researchers at Johns Hopkins found such systems were vulnerable to hackers. And top tap dancing great Gregory Hines has died at the age of 57. Special thanks to Lee Bartel, Gary DeLias, Lee Azzarello, Will Hoytville, and Bob C., General Manager of WOMR, Outermost Community Radio, which we celebrated last night here in Provincetown at a large gathering with Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. We go now to today's special. We thank Suki Hawley and Michael Galinsky, who made the film Horns and Halos, which included an excerpt of the interview that follows. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to play an interview that I did more than 2.5 years ago, but until today have never run. It involves President Bush, allegations of drugs, obstruction of justice, corporate scandal, and the person I interview committed suicide 2 years ago. This is how the story goes. 4 years ago, St. Martin's Press published a book by author James H. Hatfield called Fortunate Son. It's about the life of George W. Bush. The book examines Bush's past, how he made his millions, including from the Texas Rangers baseball team, the building of the stadium, the millions he made in dubious insider stock swaps, to his connections to the BCCI scandal. Hatfield also makes another charge. He says Bush was arrested in 1972 for cocaine possession. Why wasn't the future president charged, he asked. Hatfield writes that Bush's father, also the president, Bush Sr., used his political connections to have his son's record expunged. Soon after publication of Fortunate Son, Hatfield's credibility came under fierce attack. The Dallas Morning News happened to suddenly receive information about Hatfield's criminal past. He'd been convicted in 1988 of hiring a hitman in a failed attempt to kill his boss and served 5 years in prison. The media jumped all over the story. Hatfield's reputation and credibility were ruined. St. Martin's Press promised to turn Fortunate Son into, quote, furnace fodder. It withdrew 70,000 copies of the book from bookshelves and destroyed them. The editor-in-chief of St. Martin's Press resigned. But a small publisher, Soft Skull Press, reprinted the book with the banner, "The Book They Burned Is Back." J.H. Hatfield had previously refused to reveal the source of his information about Bush's alleged cocaine arrest. He now decided to name him. It was none other, he said, than Karl Rove, Bush's closest political advisor. But the media kept following the trail laid out for them. They diverted inquiries about Bush's drug history to stories about Hatfield's checkered past. He lost two other book contracts and faced financial ruin and obscurity. The character assassination finally took its toll on July 20th, 2001. J.H. Hatfield was found dead of an apparent suicide in a hotel room in Springdale, Arkansas. He was 43 years old. Police said he left notes for his family and friends that listed alcohol, financial problems, and the book Fortunate Son as the reasons for killing himself. Well, today we're going to play the interview with James Hatfield. I started off by asking him why St. Martin's Press pulled Fortunate Son from the shelves. Well, why don't we start off with why they burned the book, or rather, why they pulled it from the shelves?
Well, no, burn's very important because in this country you don't burn books. Publishers are supposed to publish books. The major controversy surrounding the book when it first came out was my past. The book came out on a Tuesday, and by Friday it was recalled because they found out I had a criminal history. And so the publisher said they doubted my credibility at that point, which didn't make any sense because before that they said it was meticulously fact-checked. scrupulously corroborated, and 54 pages of source notes, so you can't say that one day and go, okay, maybe he had a pass, but one doesn't have anything to do with the other.
Mm-hmm. What did your pass have to do with this? Had you denied it before?
Well, I did deny it when I was first approached to St. Martin's. We got a call from a reporter with the Dallas Morning News when I was in New York doing publicity for the book, and the publisher asked me, and I did deny it until I got home a few hours later and talked to my family and talked to my lawyer and stuff like that. And then we tried to work it out with the publisher so we could get it back out again.
Can I ask what your criminal history was, and then
sure.
We will go through the book?
The crime that got the attention was that I was involved in a conspiracy to try to kill somebody, and that certainly made the headlines.
How long did you serve time in prison?
5 years in Texas.
Who'd you try to kill?
Associate of mine. I was a vice president in a real estate company, and she was the other vice president, and I kind of got caught in the middle between a blackmail scheme with my boss, and she was blackmailing him, and I passed the money.
Was she killed?
Oh, no. She's that's not to lessen the severity of it, but she wasn't hurt at all.
Mm-hmm. So when did you get out of jail?
1994.
And when did you start writing this book?
About October of 1998, after the elections in 1998, and the Republicans lost in the House, and Newt Gingrich and those rascals were kicked out, and all of a sudden Bush won in a landslide, and they thought he would be the future of the party.
Why did you take up George W. Bush, the governor of Texas, as your subject?
Well, that's a very good question, because at the time that I pitched the book, he wasn't that well known outside the country. There were some hypothetical polls taken in a matchup, rather, with Gore, that he would win. Nobody knew anything about him except that he was very popular in Texas. My family, my in-laws are all from Texas. I go down there a lot, and I used to live, of course, in Texas, in a couple of places. And he fascinated me from a biographer's point of view. As a subject, he was a fascinating person because of his history and who his father was. And as a biographer, you're always looking for somebody to write about that you had to have an interest in. It's just like having a regular job. You don't want to go to work hating your job. You got to like what you're doing. And I thought that would be a good book to work on. And I also wanted to let the American people know a little bit more about him.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of George W. Bush as you see him.
I think the title really sums it up, Fortunate Son. This is a guy that his entire life he succeeded because of who he is and his family heritage. He went to Andover because of his family connections. He went to Yale because of his father and his grandfather's connections. Texas Law School turned him down, but he got into Harvard because of family connections. He set out in the oil business in Midland back in the 70s, and just because of his family's name, he got a lot of investors, even though all his businesses failed. He never was successful in the oil business. It was all bailouts and swap deals and that type of thing. And then he bought into the Texas Rangers for $600,000, while all the other investors paid millions. But his father had just been elected president, and they wanted him to be the managing general partner, so he was essentially the face of the team. And then he used that to propel his candidacy for governor. If he was George Smith, he would have never been elected governor because he was running against a very charismatic, popular person even outside of Texas, and that was Ann Richards. And now, here he's raised all this money. Nobody knows anything about the guy. He's an empty suit. We're starting to learn a little bit more about him now. And it's the money that's been raised is because he's George Bush and the son of a former president.
Let's talk about his time in Midland as an oil businessman. You go into great detail in the book about the kinds of people who bailed him out, their connections to his father and the family, and the connections to the Persian Gulf War, and etc. Why don't you give us a little more detail?
Yeah, he's made a lot of money and by being bailed out by his dad's friends. Like, for example, his first company, Arbusto. One of the major investors was James Bath, who had connections to the BCCI scandal and Osama bin Laden family. And why would somebody invest in the son of a vice president's first little oil company? I mean, you have to have an interest. Just like right now, he's raised $70 million. When he gets to the White House, if he gets to the White House, you're naive if you don't think those corporate people that got him there don't want something in return.
His oil company, Arbusto, is Spanish for Bush.
Spanish for Bush.
Now, you mentioned Osama bin Laden. Can you talk about what you think those connections are?
Well, not just myself, but I also document in the book that a couple of award-winning former Time correspondents wrote a book on BCCI, and they also mentioned Bath. They said that the $50,000 that he invested in Arbusto had to come from BCCI because he didn't have any money of his own, and from the connections he had with the Osama bin Laden family. So,
you said the bin Laden. You said that Osama bin Laden is the son of the businessman he did work with. Do you know that for sure? Is that right, that the bin Laden brothers, that is, Osama bin Laden is one of their sons?
Well, it's in the family, they said. So you can't say that he actually did business with Osama bin Laden, but you have to say it was family. It'd be like if somebody did business with the Bush family. You'd say, well, I don't know if George W. is actually involved in it, but it would be with the family, and there's no denial there.
How do you know that the bin Laden brothers are related to Osama bin Laden?
Well, that's been documented in lots of places. Not just me, but other newspapers, other journalists, TV, elsewhere.
And what is Bath's connection to the Bushes?
Well, he was also in the National Guard with George W. back in the 70s, which is interesting, too, because in 1972, in August, my publisher was able not too long ago to get a hold of Bush's National Guard records. And in 1972, at the same time we alleged that he was doing community service for a cocaine arrest, James Bath, who was in the unit with him, both of them were grounded for failing to show up for their medical exam.
Wait, what did you say about drugs?
Oh, the drug question. Well, that's the $64 question that we raise in the afterword of the book. We say that George W. Bush was arrested in 1972 for possession of cocaine, and his father got it fixed, and he did community service at Project Pool, a minority mentoring program, a tough area in Houston, for 1 year.
Now, how do you know he got arrested for cocaine?
Because we have three sources in the book, three confidential sources, but nevertheless, they're close friends of Bush. They've been close friends for many years, all the way back to when he was a boy. And they were also sources that I used consistently through the book, and the other stuff that they told me about was corroborated by secondary and third sources.
And what exactly did they say?
Basically, essentially the same thing, each one of them, and I was very careful not to lead the other one on and say, okay, here's the story, here's what the other person told me. I would ask, is it true about the cocaine in 1972, and they would tell me the story.
And what's the story that they told you?
That he was picked up, he was taken to jail, he called his father, of course. His father, at the time, was UN ambassador. There is some conflicting stories I have of whether he was actually in town in Houston at that time or whether he was in New York. But the truth is, what they all say is that he contacted the judge that was going to handle the case and said, look, I'm a benefactor at Project Pool. I support them. I'll make sure George W. does his time there in community service. And the judge let him out of there. And that's where he spent the next year.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Part of the controversy in the St. Martin's book was that the facts could not be backed up. For example, didn't you say that the judge was a Republican judge and he was a Democratic judge?
No, I never said that. I have three sources in the book that tell the same story. Two of them say that it was a state judge in Texas. One of them says it was a Republican judge. One doesn't have anything to do with the other. Like I've said a million times, actually, because of that, it validates my corroboration process. Because if it had just been one source that said, hey, it was a Republican, I'd be in a lot of trouble. But you got two other sources that say it was a state judge, and it's been almost 30 years. Now it's all Republican judges in Harris County, and at that time they were all Democrats. But the fact of the matter is the judge was a good friend of the elder Bushes.
Mm-hmm. And is the judge dead now?
I don't know. We don't know who the judge is. There's a lot of people working on this right now because of the exposure that we've got on 60 Minutes and the book coming back out. My publisher and myself, we're getting tips from people, we're getting email. It's amazing. So we feel like that before the election time this year, the afterword is definitely going to be validated, and I'll be vindicated.
Now, explain the story exactly as you understand it. What was he picked up for?
Possession of cocaine. I believe, although my source denied it, one of them, I believe that one of them might have been there with him when it happened.
Where did they say it happened?
Harris County in Houston.
Where?
Well, I don't know exactly where, but on the street or something, and they were taken to the jail.
Were they buying at the time?
I don't think so. I think it was just pure possession is the way the story was told to be. But we've received email, and like I was saying a minute ago, and stories from other people that went to school with him and said he was selling drugs when he was at Yale. And then a lot of people are starting to respond to that now. So I think there may be a little bit more to this story than even we had in the afterword of the book.
Did you have any indication he was selling in Houston?
I never heard that when I was working on the book, and I also followed up on a lot of stories because people used to say he was high when he flew planes for the Air National Guard, but I never found any evidence to that effect, so it didn't go in the book. It's not true, it doesn't go in the book.
Did you have any indication of other times he had run-ins with the law around drug use or selling or possession?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because there's a new introduction to the reissued book now from Soft Skull, written by Nick McModis and Toby Rogers, that they have an on the record interview with Michael Dannenhauer, who is the Elder Bush's former chief of staff, where he says that George W. had problems with alcohol and women and drugs back in the 70s, and I quote, "lost weekends in Mexico." And the mainstream press has kind of glossed over that since the book's come back out because they said, give us some hard proof. Now we got hard proof. We got a former chief of staff for the Elder Bush on there who's also a family friend and certainly knows his history. Nobody wants to talk about it.
You're listening to an interview with J.H. Hatfield, author of Fortunate Son. He died of an alleged suicide 2 years ago. This is the first time we're playing the interview. We'll be back with J.H. Hatfield in a minute.
Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige, and brown, Mr. Backlash.
Backlash Blues, Nina Simone, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the interview with J.H. Hatfield, author of Fortunate Son. Again, this is the book that was burned or shredded by St. Martin's Press and then republished by Soft Skull Press. J.H. Hatfield has since died 2 years ago of an alleged suicide. In his book, Hatfield charges that George Bush was arrested for cocaine possession in 1972. He says three unnamed sources claimed a judge had expunged Bush's case and given him a sentence of community service as a favor to his father. James Hatfield died after we did this interview months later. I also spoke in the interview with Toby Rogers, who wrote the introduction to the Soft Skull Press edition of Fortunate Son. He says he spoke with the former chief of staff of George Bush Sr. I asked him to describe what happened in those conversations.
Originally, I wasn't there to get a cocaine story on GW. I'm doing my own book on the Bush family, and I was down there for a year. The Presidential Library, President Bush's library, was just opening up. I was actually really there to get some information on Islam P. Adam, who is a heroin trafficker that was busted by the feds in 1985. And 2 days before President Bush left office, he was pardoned. And I always thought that story was, you know, something worth pursuing. It was blacked out by the press. Everyone was kind of swept up in the Clinton inauguration. Well, again, I was there to get stuff about Islam P. Adam. I also wanted to find out more about the Reverend Yong Sung Moon and President Bush. None of that I was able to get any information on. In fact, the pardon that you can get from the Justice Department is not in the presidential library. But as the conversation unfolded, we're talking about, you know, some of the rumors, you know, about drinking and the womanizing stories and also the drugs. And he just seemed to be, more open about GW than the father. He seemed very protective of his boss, but was very, open about the son, which I thought interesting.
When did you do the interview? Had George W. Bush said he was running for president at that point?
It hadn't officially announced. This was in April of 98, so this was almost a year before. There was, you know, down there was talk of GW running, and we talked about that when I met with Dan and Howard. We talked about, you know, and he was telling me that President Bush was really excited about the upcoming campaign and whatnot.
And tell me exactly what Dan and Howard said to you about George W. Bush.
I said, you know, there are rumors. I heard that, you know, there's rumors about drugs and women and drinking, and he basically said, you know, there's cocaine use. There was women, but, you know, the drinking was really his main problem, according to him, who I guess didn't have a lot of knowledge and first-hand knowledge of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What did he say about drugs?
He said that he was a cocaine user. He didn't tell me exactly how he knew, but he knew that there was, you know, that GW had done cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I think they worked together on the 88 campaign. And that's where I know that Dan Howard was an intern from 85 up, and GW has kind of had that special position as the hatchet man at the 88 Bush campaign. So, you know, if you read any of the books about the 88 campaign, GW was like, he was nicknamed the hatchet man. He would be running around making sure he was the enforcer of loyalty. So, obviously, someone who's an employee of the president's going to be, they might have had to, you know, rub the wrong way or something, you know.
How did he know he used cocaine?
He told me, his boss told him, President Bush.
And J.H. Hatfield just mentioned Lost Weekends. What is
yes.
that about?
If I recall correctly, that came out later in the parking lot as we were leaving. I wanted to get a little more on that, since it seemed like the only thing I really walked away with. I said, when did he start using? And he said he didn't know. He said, I know it was sometime before he ran, you know, sometime before 77, which indicated to me it was before the congressional run, before he ran for Congress in 78. I said, you know, I can't remember the whole thing, but he basically said at the end, you know, there were some lost weekends down in Mexico, too, that I heard about.
What do you mean, lost weekends?
definition of lost weekend? I guess Jim probably know better about lost weekends in Mexico. I never had a lost weekend in Mexico. But I guess the definition of lost weekend is probably excessive partying and womanizing. And it's cheap liquor, cheap drugs, and cheap everything down there. And I could see how, you know, somebody with a lot of money and a lot of money to spend would want to go down there and go nuts.
That, you said you did this interview in 1998. It's now the year 2000. First of all, why did Dan and Howard, as chief of staff of Bush Sr., talk to you and tell you this?
That's a good question. It was a little bit of a covert action on my part. My dad was a heavy Republican contributor, and I used my own father as the front man to get into the Bush circle. And I was just, I do it, I guess, you know, maybe what other journalists do when they do an investigative journalism, you know, like they'll pretend they're getting a job somewhere and, you know, and then film when no one's looking. I felt like I was doing, it was under the same circumstances. So I told them I was a Republican journalist down in Houston doing work, and basically kind of befriended him over the phone over a course of a few weeks. So we had a different kind of relationship. I think he wasn't official, but I got the assumption that this stuff was off the record also.
And now you're naming names.
And now, well, I just felt after this whole fiasco over the summer of 99 and the fall with him and this whole, you know, denials, I felt like it's just ridiculous. You know, here I have Bush's chief of staff, you know, telling me this stuff, and at the same time they can sit around and they weren't really, it was never a yes or a no answer to the question. And I thought it was just getting ridiculous after a while. And I felt the story needed to be told.
What is Dannenhauer now saying? Is he denying that he spoke to you?
He originally did when he talked to some reporters, and then the story keeps changing. It's like a revolving door with Dannenhauer. It seems like he changes the story to fit the question of the interviewer. I think he's not doing interviews now either. He's buried himself. He's not. I think it was, I don't know if 60 Minutes contacted him or not, but you know, as soon as reporters started to call him, he was immediately removed and sent down to the library to stack books.
I did see a photograph of you and him as you were coming out of or going into the office.
Going into the restaurant. Going to a downtown Mexican restaurant downtown Houston.
Toby Rogers writes the introduction to the book, Fortunate Son, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President, which is written by J.H. Hatfield. Why do you think the drug question is an important one, and why do you think George Bush has gotten away with not answering it? I mean, he has answered questions, for example, about fidelity. He said he was always faithful to his wife.
Yeah, and that's the paradox here, because he says that I've always been faithful to my wife, even though nobody asked him about it. He admits to his drinking, even though he doesn't say he was an alcoholic, but everybody that knows him says he was an alcoholic. But when it comes to the drug issue, he won't talk about it. He kind of got in a little trap here last year, and the Dallas Morning News of all newspapers kind of backed him in the corner about doing background checks if he got to be president. And then before you know it, he finally had to slam on the brakes and said, I'm not discussing drugs past 1974. Now you know why, because this what we allege with the community service thing happened in 1972. And he's never outright denied this, like Toby was saying. He's called it ridiculous. He's called it science fiction. That's Clintonian. Just come out and say, if somebody made that accusation about me, because I've seen him too many times when he's mad on television, pointing that finger, I would point that finger and say, I absolutely deny what they say in that book, but he won't do it. Now, his father, true enough, got on Fox News Channel and did an exclusive, and he said it was a vicious lie. But what is the vicious lie? That also sounds Clintonian, that he was arrested, that his record was expunged, that the elder Bush got him out. What is the lie? The American press is giving him a cakewalk on this thing, because and it's not because of the drugs. That's not the issue here, because all the other candidates have discussed drugs and whether they used it or not. The problem here is obstruction of justice. It's a privileged young man being bailed out of jail, and now as governor of Texas, he's personally changed the laws where there's in the past where you had possession of certain drugs, you got probation, and he's personally changed those laws where you get prison times. So there's hypocrisy there, and that bothers people.
Can you go back to the point where you were referring to a comment George W. Bush made about exactly how far back he could go in his history?
You mean the whole story? Yeah, the Dallas Morning News said when the FBI does the background checks on cabinet positions and everybody else, would you subject yourself to the same thing? And he said he would. And then they termed how long those are, and then finally David Blum at NBC said, well, Governor, here's the deal. It's really for life here, so how far back would you go? And he says, well, I can go back as far as like 1974. He didn't say 1974, you had to do your math, but it actually came up to, he said, during his father's campaign or something like that. And so the press finally did the math and said 1974.
He said that he could go back in his memory 25 years?
Yeah, something like that, to that effect. And that's where he slammed on the brake. And he said, from here on, I'm not discussing drugs anymore. If the American people don't like my answer, they don't have to vote for me. So why not go past 1974? Throw it on the table and discuss it. Be like me. I've put everything on the table now. And he wants to say he was young and irresponsible. I'm not even running for president. I'm talking about my past now. Why does the presidential front runner, and I'm not sure he's the front runner now, but why won't he talk about his past? And there's been lots of books too that have been written that was just pure junk, pure fabrications about Clinton. And they were never pulled off the shelves. They were never recalled. I could cite one by Aldrich that, I mean, just about every reviewer in this country said it was just horse hockey, and it was still kept out there. But they pulled mine because there was a lot of pressure to do it. It was
what
censored.
Kind of pressure?
It was censored, just plain and simple. And we don't do that in this country. We don't censor people because they want to talk about the truth. When I was doing promotions for this book originally, the publicist at St. Martin's Press told me that the reason we couldn't get any publicity, everybody was backing away. The AP didn't even want to carry it over the wire services that a book was coming out and made allegations. They weren't telling the story. They were just alleging that what was in the book. AP wouldn't cover it. So the publicist said, Jim, here's the problem. The Bush people are going around to everybody and saying, if you even report anything on this book, when we get to the White House, not if we get to the White House, but when we get to the White House, you're going to find your butt sitting outside in a folding chair outside the press room, and somebody else is going to get the story. And it sure appeared that way, because I'll tell you, we didn't get any press coverage that week. The press coverage we got is because everything came out on me, and then all of a sudden we had a controversy. I got them their press.
And ultimately, the book was pulled. St. Martin's Press pulled the book, and the publisher, the head of St. Martin's Press, resigned.
I think his title was editor-in-chief or something, Bob Wallace. Yeah, he quit over it because I was at that meeting he discussed. They hid the afterword of this book from just about everybody at the publishing company. Only Thomas Dunn and my editor, Barry Neville, and maybe one or two other people knew about it. It had a code name of MJ. And when I was in New York one day before this book was coming out, I was at that meeting, like I said, with Bob Wallace and everybody else and the chairman of the board's office. And you could tell Bob Wallace didn't know anything about this afterward until maybe just a few minutes before the meeting.
Explain what you mean by the afterward.
The afterward, of course, is all the drug allegation that was added to at the end of the book.
Why did you just add it at the end of the book?
That's kind of a long, complex story. The book was done. It was in galley forms, and I started following up on a lead. And St. Martin said, well, let's get it in there. Talk to your sources. They were comfortable with the sources. It didn't fit actually trying to put it into that part of the book where he is at Project Pool. It was going to throw off everything in the book. And also I would have had to step out of the role of biographer and tell more about the story, so it would have been first person, and then it would have got confusing, kind of like Dutch with Edmund Morris's book. So we made a decision to do it as the afterword, but there was some pressure by St. Martin's to rush it. And I would have liked to had more on-the-record sources to bolster my confidential source. Not saying I doubt their words at all. It just would have probably caused a lot less problems for me, and if I could have been able to do that.
Now, explain what it is they found that actually was inaccurate, the grounds for pulling the book.
Well, there wasn't anything inaccurate that was the grounds for the book. They only pulled the book because they said, because of my past, they distrusted my credibility.
Now, in this book, it's also the afterword?
Yes. We left it because it's the truth, for one thing. And number two, we did put a couple of footnotes, like you brought up about the Republican judge a while ago. We put that in there so we won't get beat over the head about it again. And I could have taken it out. I told Leslie Stahl that when I did the 60 Minutes. But I would have been messing with somebody's testimony. That's the way the story was told to me. Whether that person was wrong and their memory was a little foggy about whether it was a Republican or Democrat, the fact of the matter is his story was just exactly the same as the other two sources.
Why is it so hard to find the judge who did this, especially if this judge was also connected to Project Push, which he was sentenced to doing community service at?
I don't know. We've talked to several investigators since this first happened, since the book was recalled, and a lot of people are looking for this judge. We were just discussing that today with my publisher and Toby. We hope they'll find the judge. The judge may be dead, because if this was 1972 and he was a district judge, probably been about 40 or 50 years old, be about 80 now. But somebody's going to find that judge. There's too many people working on this story now. See, what happened before was the book came out on Tuesday. It was recalled by Friday. It was all over with. But now, because of the 60 Minutes story and the book coming back out again, an introduction by Toby, and we're putting all this kind of stuff out in the market now where people are reading it, all of a sudden we've got people down there investigating it. And I wish them the best of luck. I hope they can. I think they're going to run into some closed doors now, because this happened several months ago.
You're listening to an interview with J.H. Hatfield, the late J.H. Hatfield. He died 2 years ago of an alleged suicide. This is the first time we are running this interview. We'll be back with J.H. Hatfield, author of Fortunate Son, in a minute. Mm-hmm. Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the interview done more than 2.5 years ago with J.H. Hatfield, author of Fortunate Son, and Toby Rogers.
Now, Toby Rogers has named Annenhauer, who originally was an unnamed source. And, Toby, you think that he meant the story to be off the record. Did he say to you, I want this off the record?
He didn't say off the record, but at one point, he said before he said that, he said, between you and me, something. I can't remember what it was exactly. I look at my notes, but he said basically between you and me, so which doesn't mean off the record, I guess. I don't know. But he did say at one point that this is just between you, between the both of us.
And he not only decided to go public with that story, but to name Dannenhauer. Why have you not named any of the three Republicans?
I knew you were going to go with that question after you talked to Toby. Well, first of all, and this is not to slam Toby at all, but the three sources I have, two of them are very close friends of the governor. I told them from day one I would never divulge their identity. And to be honest, and it's not to say anything against you, but I'm really, frankly, getting tired of people asking me to name the sources. They don't ask other journalists to do that. I'm going to pick up the Times today, and I'm reading this whole story about George Bush, and there must be 5 times in there, according to a Bush insider. That's from the Times. But I don't want their lives to be uprooted and put in turmoil like my family has. If they're identified, it hurts. It also hurts. Kind of hard to hurt my reputation a little bit, but I think I'm a damn good journalist. And I gave them my word, and I'm going to do other books. And I think that if I sell them out, then who's going to talk to me in the future?
Why did they talk to you if they're good friends of George Bush?
Well, because when I first started this book, I said this is going to be the definitive book on George W. Bush. Even Leslie Stahl said that. It wasn't on the record. It wasn't on the tape. She said this is in the most thorough analysis of George W. Bush. I talked to a lot of his friends. A lot of them deny talking to me now. They said they wanted to get the whole story out there about his childhood. Some of it was just nuts and bolts stuff, baseball team names and stuff like that. They wanted to help. The book came out. We had the afterword about the drugs, and then what came out about me, and everybody wanted to distance themselves. And a lot of people are saying they didn't talk to me, but that goes with the territory.
But what about in this case, talking to you about the drug allegation that you have in the book, that George W. Bush was arrested for cocaine possession? Why would they tell you this if they're his friends?
Well, because I called them on it. That's another thing my publisher and Toby and I were talking about today, because some people were concerned whether I was set up. But what you got to realize is I talked to these sources for 8-9 months working on this book. They never told me about the drugs. The book was done. I called them about the drugs, and I played poker with them. I told him I was holding a royal flush and I wasn't holding anything. I said, I've got several people that are going to go on record tomorrow saying that George W. Bush was arrested for cocaine in 1972. You guys could put a positive spin on it. You know him. You're going to have to work with it in the campaign when it comes out. So here's your chance, because it's coming out in the book. That's why all three of them talked about it.
And what did each say? How did they put a positive spin on it?
Well, they didn't really put a positive spin. There's not a positive spin you can put on that story. They just tried to tell it the best they could, how it came about. And like I said a while ago, they all said the same story.
Mm-hmm. And tell that story one more time that they said.
That he was arrested in 1972 for cocaine. He was taken to the Harris County Jail. He called his dad. His dad called, found out who the judge was. It was somebody he knew because Bush had been party chairman down there, had been a congressman from that district and everything else. He was well known, of course, and Texas judges are elected, so this was a fellow elected politician. And he said, look, just let me get him out of here, let him do some community service at Project Pool for maybe a year or something. The Elder Bush said, I'm a benefactor there, I finance him, I take care of him, we'll get over this. And that's exactly what it did. And that's why it never fit in the book, because in 1972, George W. Bush was flying for the Air National Guard. He was living in the wildest, swingingest singles place, and he was drinking, and friends say he was using cocaine back then, and he was having the time of his life. He was driving a sports car, and then all of a sudden, He's doing volunteer work, mentoring young African-American youth for about a year, and then back he went to the same old George W. And I always thought at the time, it's like one of those puzzle pieces that you try to push in. You think it looks like it's supposed to go in that hole, but it's not. It's not the right piece. And it always bugged me. So when the book got finished and I followed up on this lead, it didn't surprise me.
Did you talk to any people at Project Pull?
Yeah. Several years ago, when I was doing a piece, when I was writing in Dallas. And most of those people have been hard to find now. I didn't get a chance to talk to anybody that day. As a matter of fact, when I called Madge Bush, who's the director at the Martin Luther King Center, which was right down the street, I specifically asked her if there was anybody working at Martin Luther King Center that might have worked at Project Pool back then, because I was trying to get some more sources.
Did he ever do anything like that again? Work at a place like Project Pool after that year?
No. There was never, ever anything in the rest of his resume that goes like that. That's what's odd about it, too. It's George W. Bush is very self-centered.
I think I've heard him talk about Project Pole and what a difference it made. How does he incorporate it into his biography when he talks now?
Well, that's the funny thing about this, because when I first started on this book, all his friends always played this up. That was his first real job. That's how they describe it. First full-time job. And it was. In the Bush camp, they really pushed that on his resume. Then my book came out, and there was another book called First Son that came out. And all of a sudden, the reporter with the Dallas Morning News that wrote First Son said that he was there because he had had drinking problems, and his dad put him. And the Bushes didn't deny that. But now, so which story's true now? You can't say it was the first real job, he just did it because we wanted him to, and then now the Bushes are saying that, oh, we put him there to do community service.
Beside this allegation, were there other allegations of drug use, or when it came to alcohol, serious problems?
Serious problems, and there's been a lot of stories that have come out since then. I think it was Al Hunt, I believe that's his name, who's married to Judy Woodruff. That came out a few months ago, and we were able to get it into the book, too, that he didn't even remember several years ago being drunk and coming up to him at a restaurant, I think it was in Dallas, cursing him out in front of their family and their kids, and he said, you know, I don't remember it, but I'm sorry. I think that's what Toby was talking about a while ago with Lost Weekends in Mexico, too. There's parts of his life that's is foggy. And another point, too, is that he's had himself investigated twice. Why would you investigate yourself twice? I know about my past. I don't have to investigate my past. Unless you've got problems with your memory back there, and you don't know what you did when you were messed up on drugs or alcohol.
What do you mean, had himself investigated twice?
He hired, and he said that. It's been reported, and as a matter of fact, Doonesbury had a pretty good cartoon on it here a while back about him investigating. He has hired big private detectives to investigate his past, to see what's out there. Why would you do that?
To see what would come out in the press, true or not, I assume
right.
You would say.
Or what your opposition might find on you. Or what a journalist or a biographer might discover.
And what did these investigators find?
Well, that's never been openly discussed. Supposedly his Dallas attorney, this is what's been reported in the press by his former campaign person. I can't remember his name. He's gone now. He got fired back in the summer. But he said at the time that Bush's Dallas attorney was the repository for all the records that they found when they did the investigation. Even that had kind of a conspiratorial tone to it. And if there wasn't anything, then why why does your lawyer have to hang on to it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he changed his driver's license number. That's a key thing, too, and a lot of people made a big deal about that. He had his driver's license number. He had a completely new driver's license issued in March of 1995. Because in Texas, whatever arrest or any kind of fine you pay, whether it's a misdemeanor, it's attached to your driver's license record. And he had, of course, he'd killed an endangered bird back in the 94 campaign. That was on that driver's license. So according to the sources, he had that driver's license changed because there was a stale but telltale trail there that might have led investigators to find something.
Now, what do you mean? If you have your driver's license number changed, then we don't know what the original number was?
No, we don't know what the original number was, and everything that was attached to that is gone. I mean, he has a completely new driver's license that he got in 1995. Now, his explanation after his campaign finally got it together, because they were taken by surprise when it first happened and people were calling. It was Online Journal, two ladies, Ben Conover and Linda Starr, that broke that story. He said it was for security reasons, which is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life, because the elder Bush lives in Houston. I've seen when I've been down there. He's a former president. He hasn't had his Texas driver's license changed, and Saddam Hussein wanted to kill him. I mean, Clinton went over there and bombed Iraq because it was an assassination tip he found out on Bush. So, but the younger son, George W., wants to change his for security reasons. It just doesn't fly.
Why can't you find out the original number? Wasn't he governor still at the time that it was changed?
Yes, he was, and that's sealed. Because one of the major reasons is that the Director of Public Safety, which is the agency that's responsible for driver's license, and the Texas Rangers, not the baseball team, but the infamous law enforcement agency, the Texas Rangers.
You think he owned them, too?
Well, the law enforcement or the... Well, I don't know. You said that. I didn't. But he had his driver's license number changed, too. And he's a big supporter. He's a good friend of Bush's, the head of the Department of Public Safety. And he's one of his major fundraisers. I think his name's Bird. So, I don't know.
What does that have to do with anything, that he had his change, too, at the same time?
No, not at the same time. But it's just, okay, so he's governor, you can go out and get a new driver's license. And if you're the head of the Department of Public Safety, you can go out and get a new driver's license. The question is, why, though? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense.
But certainly an investigative journalist could go dig up that old driver's license, especially if he was using it even as governor, and he had it for years.
Well, as a matter of fact, like I said, Linda Starr and Bev Conover, that wrote the original piece for Online Journal, I talked to them last week, and that's one of the things they're working on right now, is to do up a follow-up piece, and they're trying to find out what that original number was so that they can maybe do a follow-up, see what's there.
Were there any of these kind of investigations done when he ran for governor?
Ann Richards was a very formidable opponent. She dug up a lot of stuff, like the SEC investigation where he bailed out at Harkin and cashed in his stock right before the company plummeted. And he sat on the financial board of the company, so he knew what was coming on. She brought all that up during the campaign. She also talked about all the businesses he's been associated with or sat on the board of directors and had lost a combined, I think, almost $350 million. Somebody asked me the other day, and it's a very good question. If there was this thing with Bush with the drugs, why didn't Ann Richards bring it up? And I talked to both camps when I was working on the book. And Ann Richards, a recovering alcoholic, and during her primary, Jim Maddox, who was the Attorney General, brought up issues that Ann Richards had used cocaine. So from what I was told from the Richards camp and the Bush camp is that they just kind of had a gentlemen and ladies agreement that they were not going to discuss drugs or anything else during the campaign, and they didn't.
What else do you think our listeners should know about George W. Bush?
Well, I think what your listeners are finding probably is like everybody else in America right now, that he's a name brand, and that's carried him for a long time, and that's why he's raised a lot of money, but there's nothing there. If you ask 9/10 of the people in Texas what George W. Bush stands for, polls have shown they don't know. A lot of people have been confused when they've seen the name Bush before they've seen his pictures lately in the debates. They thought the elder Bush was running again, and that kind of falsely raised his poll numbers. They're finding out now that he's not the reformer. I mean, he talks about he loves Texas, but his record in Texas clearly indicates that he doesn't really care for Texans. I mean, Texas, under his governorship, is number one out of 50 states for lack of health care for children. It leads the country now in toxic air emissions. It has the smoggiest city, Houston, in the United States now. It's past L.A. He says he's a reformer when it comes to education, but the teacher salaries rank 36th in the nation when he went into office, and when he was sworn back in his second term in January of 1999, it ranked 38th, so it's actually dropped. And literacy, I think, rates about 48 or 49th out of the state. George Bush is not good for the state. And he says he wants to bring to America exactly what he's done in Texas. So I think your listeners need to take a good hard look at his record.
Fortunate Son is the name of the book, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President. Has the Bush camp or George W. Bush himself threatened to sue you and the publisher of Soft Skull Press for publishing this book?
No. As a matter of fact, and I'll say this, the elder Bush lied before when he did that Fox interview, when it came out before with St. Martin's Press, before everything about my past came out. He said, I've talked to the author and I've had my lawyers check with his lawyers because I'm thinking about suing. I never heard. My lawyer never heard. What it did was scare a lot of bookstores, and it also scared St. Martin's, maybe that they thought they were going to get sued, but nobody sued. And I also think that's a telltale sign, because if it's not true, then sue.
How many books were pulled from the shelves?
They printed 104,000. We're still fighting over the numbers. We're not quite sure. We think that they probably recirculated a lot of them and they didn't burn as many as they said they thought they were going to or whatever. Mm-hmm. We don't know. I'm not getting a straight answer on it. I'm kind of public enemy number one over at St. Martin's Press, and they came off even worse than me on the 60 Minutes interview. So
that was the late James Hatfield, an interview I conducted several years ago, but we're running for the first time today. He was the author of Fortunate Son, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President. After initially refusing to reveal the sources of his information about Bush's alleged cocaine arrest, Hatfield decided to name his source. He said it was none other than Karl Rove, Bush's closest political advisor. If Karl Rove did indeed leak the information, he couldn't have leaked it to a better subject. Soon after publication of the book, Hatfield's credibility came under fierce attack. News about his criminal past quickly surfaced. He'd been convicted in 1988 of hiring a hitman in a failed attempt to kill his boss and served years in jail for it. The media turned their attention to Hatfield, and his reputation, his credibility, were ruined. The allegation of cocaine possession and obstruction of justice by George Bush were forgotten in the media frenzy. George Bush and Karl Rove emerged unscathed. James Hatfield certainly did not. 2 years ago, James Hatfield was found dead of an apparent suicide in a hotel room in Springdale, Arkansas. He was 43 years old. He survived by a wife and daughter. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.